Public Affairs, May 22, 2003. And colleagues, I think the order that we're going to be looking today is the work session on introduction of speaker-approved bills and speaker-approved measure drafting requests. Then we will have a public hearing on House Bill 2931, then move to the work session on House Bill 3328. So, Representative Flores, open up the work session on introduction of speaker-approved bills and speaker-approved measure drafting requests.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Rules and Public Affairs Committee request that Legislative Council prepare the legislative draft as presented in the two letters to Speaker Minnis dated May 22, 2003.
Thank you. Representative Flores has moved. The House Rules and Public Affairs Committee requests the Legislative Council prepare the legislative drafts as presented in the two letters to Speaker Minnis dated May 22, 2003. Any discussion?
Perhaps more accurately for the record, Mr. Chair, one letter is dated May 22 and one is dated May 21.
Oh, thank you for that clarification. Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And close the work session and... you need to then open up the work session on introduction of committee bills.
Mr. Chair, I move Legislative Council Draft 3631 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Flores has moved LC Draft 3631 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Is this the bill that would establish a program like PEB?
It is, for education.
I'm glad to see this one coming. I'd like the chance to consider it.
Well, guess what?
Yes.
It's coming back. All right. Any other discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And I can close the work session and open up public hearing on House Bill 2931. Larry Nisswinder.
Chair Doyle, committee members, for the record, Larry Nisswinder from Legislative Fiscal Office. The chair had asked me to come today to respond to any questions or provide you some general background information on House Bill 2931. I have given the committee administrator some handouts for you that relate to vacant positions, and similar information has been provided to the caucus offices. But basically, just to give you a background for this bill, there are vacant positions in state government during this 0103, and this is what the information on the handouts reflect. There are a number of reasons why those positions are vacant due to the unique budget circumstances we find ourselves in during this biennium. And I have attached to that a list of some of the common reasons why positions are vacant for your background information as well. And there are some statistics there just to let you know about the nature of the vacant positions, whether they're permanent, full-time, part-time, which agencies they're located in, as well as the type of funds that are commonly used to fund those positions. So.
And before you begin, committee members, there's a, I think in context for this bill, proposal was that last session, regular session, this body had passed a law that required agencies to report to DAS any vacancies that they had that were over 6 months. And there have been reports to emergency board through LFO during the interim, and then in addition to that, through direction from the co-chairs and both House and Senate leadership, there's been analysis of vacant positions, and this bill is just being considered at least as the next step. I mean, we're getting the information to show that there are a number of vacancies that exist. So what do we do with it as a policy discussion? Do we just continue taking the information, or do we basically come up with an answer like this that suggests that if there is such a vacancy, that after a certain period of time, for purposes of budget management and truth in budgeting, you know, that we have an obligation that, you know, would then allow the, by law, that these positions become, are removed from the budget. So, in that context, we first wanted to get the information about the vacant positions, and leave that to Mr. Nicewander.
The positions that are vacant are often used for unbudgeted expenses, and that was the case in 0103. Our office is currently, as the chair indicated, going through a detailed process of going through vacant positions that are currently exist that are budgeted in 0305 to see which ones would be recommended to be eliminated or and the funding reduced, or to true up the budget to, if they have in fact relied on the funding for that position for some other expense the legislature's directed them to incur, then we would still abolish the position and shift the funding to where it is actually being used to sort of provide, restore, if you will, truth in budgeting as to where the money is actually being spent, have it be reflected that way in the budget. So each of the agencies are going to make ways and means are having a vacancy position review done in relationship to this. And the criteria established by the co-chair are quite strict to say, are they required to deal with mandated caseloads? Are they required to deal with constitutional orders, court orders, mandates, and or essential, just basic essential services for the agency? Otherwise, the recommendation would be to abolish the FTE if it's a long-term vacancy and they cannot justify keeping it. So the effort is going on. This would further sort of provide a structure wherein automatically after 4 months the positions would be abolished and the funding linked to those positions unallotted. The allotment process is a process that the executive branch executes on a quarterly basis. They tell agencies what they're allowed to expend from their budgeted funds, go over plans and approve those. And as you recall during this last interim, that allotment plan was used to help balance the budget. The governor unallotted funds on the last time about $112 million to restore balance. So the act of this bill would be to say if it's a vacant performance, the executive branch would be directed to take the funding linked to that position and take it out of that allotment or expenditure authority plan and set it aside, regardless of fund type, whether it was general fund, other fund, or federal funds. So,
and Larry, just to expand on that a bit, and I think at least one of the concerns with this bill is that, you know, there may be funds that come through federal fund allocations that might be linked, that if a position has not been filled, that there's danger of losing those funds as well. Can you get into that discussion a bit?
Yes, Chair and committee members. In a large agency, such as like with the Department of Human Services, there are workload fluctuations, and they do have positions that are caseload driven, and they fill them on an as-needed basis. They may be established in the budget as permanent full-time positions, but if they're not needed, for instance, the food stamp program or another caseload-driven ones related to family services or health services. If we have federal funds that support those positions, and the match rate in DHS is somewhere around 50-60%, when the workload is there and the positions are available to be used and the federal funds are provided to the department, they have when they have the ability to hire those positions, we get the authority to use the federal funds to run the program. So if the positions sit vacant while there isn't adequate caseload to support them, the importance is that they would be available when the funds are there and when the workload is there. So if they're abolished and not available when the workload showed up and when the funds were there, then it would require some form of action, possibly at the emergency board, to reestablish position authority.
Sure, Representative Mons Anderson.
Thank you. I'm thinking of two cases and see how this fits in. One, for instance, the superintendent of Portland Schools, they tried forever and ever and ever trying to get that filled. And that went over how many years? And then I'm also thinking about a position for Clackamas County Public Health. Very difficult to try and find a physician for their full-time physician. And a third, actually, example would be clinic manager, actually, again, for Clackamas County Public Health, where it was very difficult to find someone to fill that. And it was, eventually we filled it, but I think it was more like, I know it was more than a year, I'm not quite sure how long. What about those positions that are very difficult? You need a specialized person, right? And sometimes you can get somebody and then you offer them a job and then boom, you know, they turn it down. I think that happened actually to Portland. So how about those kinds of positions?
Chair Doyle and Representative Anderson, that's an example where there are where the recruitment difficulties exist, where a four-month period of time, you could spend that much time possibly just getting the announcement out, getting the list, selecting interviewees, and then having them be selected. So anytime you have trouble getting people to apply, anytime you have people run the whole process through and then turn the job down, yes, that four-month period could lapse. Yeah. And you would have, without an exception to that, you could have potentially a position abolished. Now, the positions you referenced are not subject to this, obviously, because they're not state agency positions under executive branch control. But nonetheless, there are recruitment difficulties, and in a four-month period, you know, sometimes that would not allow for that, and yet the need would still be there. So I guess if you carried it to that all the way through, you wouldn't, again, probably increase activities in the interim where agencies would have to come in and say, 4 months lapsed, this position was abolished and the funding unallotted. We need the emergency board to reestablish that position and also reestablish the expenditure authority, you know, to deal with that. And it could increase the emergency board workload as a result of that. Just because if you want to have the position filled and it's a necessary need and it's justified, there need to be a legislative action probably taken.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a series of questions, but maybe I can condense it down into one. Would you describe for us how it is that a position comes into being and how a position goes away now without this bill?
Okay. In general, the positions, permanent positions, are established by the legislature, when the legislature adopts a budget. You know, each biennium, agencies submit an agency request to the governor. The governor's office and DAS ultimately approve what's going to come forward in the governor's recommended budget. But until the legislature adopts the budget, you know, and the position authority related to it, every one of those budgets that come out of Ways and Means, the bill itself just references the dollars and the expenditure authority. But the budget report itself confirms the number of permanent positions and FTE that the agency is authorized to hire for the biennium. So if during the interim the executive branch has the ability to establish limited duration positions, if they're justified and workload is there, they have, that's an executive branch authority that they have. However, that is limited to the interim period in which, or the period in which they authorize them. Once it comes back before the legislature, it's up to the legislature to say whether or not they continue or not. And by operation of law, they go away. Limited duration positions will go away unless the legislature acts to continue them as limited duration or make them permanent.
That's half of my question. Now, the other half is, how do we make positions go away?
Once again,
or disappear or lose their being, whatever the term is.
It's really the process of adopting the budget. There are people that go away, positions that remain vacant for other reasons. For instance, if there's a revenue loss, maybe the federal funds for a position or the other fund fee revenue is not adequate to support it, then agencies, you know, can't fill it and maintain their responsibilities to have a balanced budget. But the actual position authority is established through the budget bill, and it would be abolished through that as well. It isn't an emergency board authority in the interim to abolish. They can establish positions, and they can increase limitation and appropriations, but the emergency board doesn't have the authority to reduce overall agency limitation or reduce their appropriation or their position
authority. Okay, Paul? Another, if I may. Now, a minute ago, you mentioned that sometimes funds that are designed for, that are set aside in the budget in connection with a position or a set of positions, some of those funds might end up being used for something else. How does that happen, and what kind of reports does the agency or the governor make to the legislature about that, if any?
Chair Doyle and committee members, in the interim, the agencies complete what's called quarterly allotment plans, and they do disclose how they actually use the funds to the executive branch, and they have some latitude to move those positions around within expenditure categories. And so there is a quarterly process that the executive branch goes through to review and approve those, and that's where the disclosure comes. It would come before the legislature if the legislature would request for, and they do periodically have agencies come forward with reports on how they're doing in managing their budget, where they have unfunded expenses. Periodically those kinds of requests do come forward to the legislature, but it's on a request basis only.
Okay. Well, and then the final question, and I'm not sure I quite say this. One of the things we could do then, I suppose, instead of simply closing positions by operation of a passage of time, would be to require that this allotment report come to the legislature itself when it's considering budgets. Could we do that? Or maybe the governor's response to the allotment reports, or so that we can keep up with positions that are actually are vacant and unnecessary, and funds ought to be in a different category, or things of that sort?
The chair and committee members, in a way that does happen through the Ways and Means process now, in that when agencies come in and submit their biennial budget request, there is budget history also provided in the budget notebooks that says, here's what the legislature approved for expenditure, and even by category, and then here's how the estimated expenditures the agency has incurred in the biennium up to the date that the budget was developed. So that information is available. Then it's just a matter of what level of detail do you want beyond what's in the budget notebook. You know, if you want to say, okay, it says here you spent $3 million on positions, you were budgeted for $4 million, can you tell us what created the difference? You know, and where, in fact, you know, did you have vacancies, and what was the funding for those positions used for? Those kinds of things can be provided, but it would probably want to be done on a case-by-case basis versus everybody doing that, because it would be a considerable amount of work to sort of track a full biennium's expenditures, position by position, and provide those reports. I mean, where there are significant differences, those kinds of things can be done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Larry, I apologize. I came in slightly late, so if you've already covered this, I apologize. You have in your testimony that 20,000, about 20,500 statewide positions are subject to the hiring freeze. And then you say that a number of positions are not subject to the hiring freeze because they are other funds. Is that correct?
That's correct. When the hiring freeze was established in June by the governor, it was for positions that were either general funded or lottery funded or some portion.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, follow up. My question is, if we've got about, I think we have over 40,000 state employees now, 20,000 are subject to the hiring freeze, and is it fair to say that about 50% of them are not subject to the hiring freeze?
The statewide numbers, I think that's probably, that's accurate.
Okay, Mr. Chair, when I see these half-page ads in the Statesman hiring people, there are a lot of positions being put up and advertised, correct?
That's correct, and there are some criteria that they were directed to apply when deciding whether they were in fact subject to it and able to hire, in terms of if they were for public safety, public health, welfare, and there are some other criteria that the executive branch did develop for the agencies to utilize. So some meet those criteria.
Okay, and last follow-up. Could you just talk about this double fills? Because the way this is stated here, I don't understand. It says, positions may be identified as vacant when the funding for the position is actually being used to cover the cost a person that is assigned to a position that is already assigned to another person. What does that mean?
means if you and I were employees in a department and they put the payroll records reflect that you and I were assigned to the same position number. And it may be because you're in a classification that is higher, and there isn't a position actually that, let's say the position they put us in fits are the jobs and our duties, and there isn't actually a position that they could separate those into yet. They're going through a reclassification process, or maybe the need for both of us to be in that position is temporary. They have some latitude to use that assignment for more than one person. Oftentimes those situations are corrected when the proper classified position does exist, and then they put the person in the position. But in the meantime, they're in order to fund you in that same position as me, there's probably another position sitting vacant, and the funding that is linked to that position is being used to pay for your salary.
So how many do you estimate there are double fills?
Well, I think in this handout there was a table. I don't know if I brought it with me today. Let's see, my copy doesn't have it. I think, there was, I didn't bring the table with me. I may have one.
No, it appears there's a page missing, but maybe not.
That may be, yes, I think there is a page missing, so I'll get you that. At the time this report was done, I think around the end of January, there were, looks like there were approximately a little over 200 in the state that were double fill positions. So.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Moss-Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to have you define what executive department is. And the reason I'm asking that is I'm thinking of corrections. And, you know, we do have a shortage of physicians and nurses, and I know that it's very difficult to find nurses and physicians to work in the state corrections facilities. Mm-hmm. I want to get at what is executive department, and are those people, would they be a part of this?
Sure. In ORS 174.112, there is a definition of executive department, and I'm not sure if the bill references that specific definition or not. Yes, it does. Actually, it's on Section 1, Line 5 of the bill. What that statute says is that the executive department means all statewide elected officers other than judges, all boards, commissions, departments, divisions, or other entities without regard to their designation, given to these entities that are within the executive department of the government, as described in Article 3 of the Constitution, that are not, A, in the judicial department or the legislative department, local governments, or special government bodies. That's essentially it. So it leaves out the judicial department and the legislative department. So corrections would be included.
So physicians and nurses would be included.
As long as they're in.
I don't know all of the hard to hire positions, and so that's why I'm just throwing out physicians.
They would be included if they were in.
They would be included. Thank you.
First questions, Representative Beckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Larry, I'm reading the handout. What are the various reasons positions are vacant? Historically, if we could take a historical look at this. Has it changed much over the years? Is it more dramatic now relative to the number of employees? Do we have more vacancies now, say, than some years ago? Is there a trend, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Chair and committee members, I don't have the probably historical data here with me to quote any numbers, but we generally see about, on a normal course, probably about a 1% statewide vacancy factor. This is significantly higher than that, and it is unique. I mean, the hiring freeze definitely was a factor. The reduction in general fund during this biennium was a factor. Obviously, of late, the number of retirements has their bearing on that as well. So it's higher than normal.
Okay. No other questions? appreciate your testimony. And members, just so you know, this Mr. Nicewinder came at the request of the chair just to provide some factual background. He's not here to, as proponent or opponent of this bill. Let's see, Cindy Becker.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members
Welcome.
Of the committee. My name is Cindy Becker. I'm the Assistant Director of the Department of Administrative Services, and we are here to testify in opposition to House Bill 2931. All of the reasons for vacancies are very well documented in the paper that Larry just handed out to you, and so I'm not going to go through those unless you have specific questions about types of vacancies. I've worked in three different states and a variety of different state agencies in Oregon, so I have a lot of hands-on experience around managing vacancies. And I think what this bill is going to do is probably have the exact opposite effect of what you are seeking. I know that folks have been very concerned over the past year, particularly about the government's perceived use-it-or-lose-it mentality. There's lots of discussion about people buying things at the end of the biennium, for example. This bill would actually feed into that very cycle. If agencies feel they're going to lose a position, they're going to fill it. Most agencies are trying to manage their vacancies. They're looking at their workload. They're trying to figure out how can they manage their resources and manage their vacancies. This bill takes away all that flexibility. Also, as was stated earlier, 4 months is not a lot of time from the initial identification of a position to recruitment, to the interviewing process, to offering the position, to the person having to take 2 to 4 weeks before they come on board. That's really cutting it short, and that assumes that everything works exactly perfectly, and we know that doesn't happen. I think with a combination of the hiring freeze, layoffs, and coupled with folks leaving because of concerns about PERS, agencies aren't in the position to do the type of planning they already want. This would limit them even more. You know, a year ago, you'd hear people saying, well, I'm going to retire in a year, or I'm going to retire in 10 months, and now people are saying, I'm going to retire in 2 weeks. That doesn't give the agencies very much time to figure out what they need to do, how they're going to provide the service or functions of that position, how to recruit for the right person, get them in within 4 months. But I think the larger issue here is changing government, from our perspective, really speaks to changing the systems, changing how we do business. A bill such as this doesn't get to it. What it does is take away any flexibility that agencies have to be able to manage the systems that have been statutorily mandated, have been given to them by the federal government. Those positions are there to carry out mandates from the state or the federal government. This type of bill will really tie their hands in a time when they're already suffering from lots of vacancies, trying to get the work done. And what will happen is, as I said earlier, if they feel they're going to lose the position, they're going to fill it. And so I don't think it's going to get to where you want to go. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Ms. Becker, considering the fact that we have about a 50% reduction right now, as I'm understanding this information, and the workload that is then being carried on by various agencies, could you comment on what effect that reduction is having on workload agencies-wide?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, when you say 50% reduction, can you explain the 50%? I'm sorry.
The number of vacancies that have been left as a result of the hiring freeze, and then those employees left in place in order to assume the business of the state government.
Representative Flores, what I can tell you is from speaking from very intimate knowledge, I'm currently in three positions. There are three people who are no longer at the department that I am assuming those responsibilities. I have no life. But I can tell you that...
Welcome to our world.
Right, but you get to go home. And, you know, I'm not holding myself out as anything unusual. I think this is what's happening all over the place. People are having to assume responsibilities, and they're trying to get, you know, the bare minimum done, that they can get done. People are leaving. People are leaving with extensive knowledge, those PERS employees that are leaving. And they're left to move everything forward, and they're juggling. They're just doing a lot of juggling, and they're trying, you know, they come to work with the best of intentions to get their work done. And they're trying to figure out what's the fire they have to put out, and that's certainly not the way we want to manage.
Follow up. Then, are you suggesting there's a decrease in efficiencies of the levels of services that are being provided?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I think there is, I think you need to separate out the systems and the people. I think people come to work, they're putting everything they possibly can towards their jobs. I think we have some antiquated systems. I think we have some paper-intensive systems that people are trying to wade through. And when you have a full complement of staff, it's a lot easier to work around and work through that. And when you have a much reduced staffing complement, it gets more difficult. So I think that I don't want to attribute less efficiency on the part of people who are coming to do a really good job. I think we've got some inefficient systems.
Thank you.
Further questions? Ms. Becker, I'm curious your position about what seems to be kind of a common budgeting practice in the past is to go ahead and, I mean, certainly in the Boone years where agency heads would request additional positions merely to either pad their budgets or to give them that flexibility you speak of, but only to divert that money to other uses instead of for the actual FTE, that they go through the entire Ways and Means process saying this FTE is justified, knowing full well they were never going to fill that position. How do we deal with that kind of position?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't believe that anyone consciously requests positions that they know full well they're not going to use. I think they have the best intentions of them. I think the budgeting process, when they request that a year before we actually come, before the legislature, has an impact. I can tell you, though, and you, I'm sure, know this very well, is that agencies are also given things to fund, given expenses to fund that they're not given funding for. A great example is collective bargaining. Over the past several biennia, when collective bargaining increases were negotiated, agencies, in fact, were not given the revenue to cover that, and they had to find the revenue from within their agency. So they looked at natural turnover and vacancies and holding vacancies so, in fact, they wouldn't have to cut program. Another area is in overtime. Agencies are typically not funded with enough money for overtime. You see this in state hospitals and direct care workers and caseworkers. And so, again, they use the money from the vacant positions as a stopgap to fund that overtime. So part of it is the agencies are trying to fund those mandates that they're given without any funding.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mary Botkin. Let you wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I want to respond to a couple of things I've heard, but I also want to draw your attention to some things, and I want to actually talk about kind of, you know, our world as we know it and vacancies. Vacancies at the State Corrections Department means that yard time goes from one officer to 100 inmates to one officer to 300 inmates. We have an incredible number of vacancies within the department. Now, under normal circumstances, under normal economic times, our union would be fighting like crazy with the Department of Corrections to fill every one of those vacancies, because those vacancies, by and large, are rank and file corrections officers and program staff. What that means is, I mean, just very simply, that we really have turned the institutions over to the inmates. And you, as elected officials and us as the union that represents people who work there are depending upon the generosity of convicted felons to keep the institution safe. And there's more of us, I mean, there's more of them than there is of us. And at a time like this, it becomes even more critical that the officers who are there on shift are alert and not being forced to live what they call in the bucket, which means they're being forced to work mandatory overtime, double shifts. Now, most officers don't want to work double shifts because they know that by the end of the second shift, they are not very, I mean, they're just not together mentally and physically because it's hard work. So that's one problem. Now, you look at the state police and you take a look at their vacancy level, and I can tell you that right now the vacancies are in the non-uniformed staff. We represent those folks. We know who they are. They're the people who run the crime labs. We've made choices. You know, now I can argue with Ways and Means over the choices they made, but the choices are the choices that they made. And we have opted for uniformed patrol officers over properly staffing our crime labs. You know, that's the reality. And so the question is, if you cut those vacancies kind of unilaterally, then how do we handle it? I can go through this OIA, DEQ, the military department. You know, we can talk about Homeland Security till the cows come home. And I have to tell you, we are not funding domestic Homeland Security. I mean, we've got an incredible level of vacancies at the military department. We have a vast number of vacancies of people who are supposed to be the first responders in any kind of a terrorist attack. Let me tell you, they better not attack because there's not a whole lot of folks out there right now.
So, Mary, if I can interrupt, are they using the money that is being set aside for these positions? If there's all these vacancies, what's happening?
I think that they use the money to fund the mandatory overtime that's being forced upon the folks who work there. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, how do you criticize an agency when you say, when they say to you, we know that our budgets are going to be cut. We know that we're going to lose probably this number of positions, and what we're trying to do is create vacancies so that we're eliminating empty spots instead of impacting real people with a family. So you force the people who are left behind to work more overtime to cover for the vacant position because you really don't want to lay off somebody in Ontario, Oregon, knowing full well that that person is not going to find another job in Ontario. And so, you know, when an officer leaves for whatever reasons or they transfer to another institution and a vacancy is created, then there's no question about it. The agency has made a decision to leave those vacancies vacant in order to adjust their staffing levels in a manner that is more humane for the workforce, which means that the people who are left are going to have to work harder and the money is going to be eaten up in a different way. I think it is very problematic. We have not been, you know, the Department of Corrections is probably the area I know the most about. We have not, as you know, Representative Doyle, I've said this before, we have not gotten current service level budgets for a long time. That means that we're not being funded at the levels that we need to be funded at to manage the inmates that we have, which means that we have to cut down on their food intake. You help do that. And, you know, we cut back on their daily allowance for food. What are we down to? About $2.30 a day now. And, you know, the reality is we still have to do things with those people. And so there are costs associated. We have not received the kind of funding we need. So the vacancies go to help support the lack of funding in other areas. And I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I'm saying it's the way it is. And then to kind of unilaterally cut the vacancies kind of solidifies the fact that we're just going to work understaffed. And that's a huge safety issue for us.
Would you think that a proposal like this would get these agencies to I guess maybe just come clean a little bit more on their overtime issues. I mean, if they're saying, hey, we're not getting these FTE assignments anymore, and we are, even though we tell you it's because we're actually going to fill a put a body in there, but we're going to end up using it for overtime. Isn't there a little bit more, being a little more truthful that way, to come back to Ways and Means to say we actually need our overtime up and we're happy to give up a few FTEs so we can get that extra overtime allocation?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I actually, when I sit through the hearings, I actually thought they were being pretty straight about their overtime needs. I mean, I've been sitting in the budget hearings, and I will, I will call foul when I think they're really fudging the numbers. But I think that most of my agencies have been pretty straight about their overtime needs.
Okay, so then to that point, I mean, why then do they still? I mean, if they're not filling those FTEs, and they're
because we pretty much unilaterally decided not to give them what they needed in overtime. I mean, when we don't give them a CSL budget, or when we don't give them what they need, then, and recruitment and retention is a huge problem.
So what you're saying is that this is their only recourse, that they have to use the FTE because they're
right.
not getting
if we want to change the way we're budgeting, then I think we change the way we're budgeting. And we do it, I've argued for years that what we ought to do is to budget what we need. Mm-hmm. And let you make the decision. Mm-hmm. about whether or not you can fund it, but let you know what that decision means. And, to be honest with you, sometimes I think they let you off the hook. But
well, and I'm sure that's true in some cases, but I guess I'm not to debate this too strongly, but it seems to me that, what we are talking about is a major philosophical change on how this state budgets. Let's be, more upfront about what those needs are. Let's budget to those needs, or make the decision we're not going to, but not use, vacancies to use as backfill.
See, I kind of thought we, Mr. Chair, I don't really see this as a debate. I don't mean to argue with you at all, because I don't think you and I are saying something different. But I just didn't think that they didn't tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't, as I sit there and listen to the budget hearings now, when I hear Karen Brazeau come in and say, if we cut 5 or 8 juvenile parole officers, this is what it's going to mean. And we, whether I oppose it or not, but, we all get painted with the same brush when it's done. If we end up with a budget that has 8 parole officers less, and Karen creates some vacancies created in another area of the budget, which allows her to buy back a parole officer because she really, really needs it, then theoretically she's not doing exactly what you wanted her to do, but she's trying to manage that agency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in some cases this really is a problem of trying to figure out how to manage your agency in very hard times in a way that gives you some flexibility within your agency budget to expand in some areas and shrink in others. And you know from working with me that I would be the first one to come and tell you if I thought they were spending money in a frivolous manner that didn't make any sense at all. And, I think that, when we look at this, I think that there are other problems that you hear about in your area, in your districts, that are even more problematic. I mean, if you look at OLCC's budget and you see that they have 17 vacancies, that doesn't really, I understand that there are people here who would like to privatize OLCC, so we're not going to go there. But I also understand, what you need to understand is that in the practical world of OLCC, these folks never miss a lick. When you talk to your bar owners or restaurant owners in your district, those folks who are changing over from one owner to another owner, I just went through this with a friend of mine who never lost a minute of pouring time on her bar in the changeover, and 3 months later has yet to get her lottery license. Those are
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary, I'm looking at the graph that Larry gave out. The second to last page, it says vacancies subject to the hiring freeze. And I would like you to comment on something that I noticed here. If you add up all the public safety jobs that are part of the vacancies, and we're all concerned about public safety, you find that if you take the state police at 5% and the Oregon Youth Authority at 3%, the Department of Justice at 2.31, and then the state police, excuse me, and corrections, it adds up to 20% of the vacancies. And yet you're only about 12% of the general fund. Then you've got education being 2% of the hiring freeze vacancies, and they're 58% of the general fund. So it seems to me what you have here is there's inequalities, and public safety has been targeted. According to this chart, you are a higher percentage of the vacancies. So it seems to me there's more going on here than just a budget problem. There's a political decision being made here.
Is there a question more?
Yes, I'd like Mary to comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I would choose to think of it as an omission on the part of somebody rather than a political target.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the point is that, you know, to use that as an example of why we shouldn't have this bill is not really a good argument, because there's inequalities here by agency. And
will you come down and help me get from my positions back?
I would be happy to, and I'm trying to at this very moment, believe me.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, if I could, on the previous comment. I think that the point that Representative Close makes is a good one, but these numbers, of course, refer only to the state employment, not to the employment in the school districts. Mm-hmm. The actual budget we ought to be comparing the Department of Education to is its general fund budget, which is about 0.33% of the total state general fund budget. And so they've actually, if they're 2% of the total, they actually have also been oversubscribed to on hiring freezes. The layoff of teachers in the school district is not reflected in these numbers because they're not state positions. Otherwise, I think your point is right on. It's exactly right.
Thank you. Other questions?
The only other comment I want to make, Mr. Chair, if you will indulge me, is tomorrow you're going to hear a series of collective bargaining bills, or you're going to receive collective bargaining bills from one of the other committees. And I just want to point out that, I mean, at some point we will testify on those bills, but it's important for you to note that one of the problems and the conflicts that we end up with in this building is that we see collective bargaining bills that are actually going to complicate the collective bargaining process and lengthen time frames and increase the hearings process, and yet ERB has three vacancies that have been eliminated. And so now you have bills are going to shrink the timelines but lengthen the process but not give us any more time. And we've eliminated people at ERB who could expedite that process. I mean, it's a conundrum for you all. And I don't think you always see all the picture. And some of us on this side of the aisle have a little better luck at seeing all of the picture because we're so many different places. And, you know, so when we talk about this stuff, we really do see some of the issues that you're struggling with, and we're struggling with it to find solutions for you, too. I mean, I think everybody's trying to help you find solutions at work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate your testimony, and I'll leave it to the individual members to decide if that's going to count towards the lobbying time on the collective bargaining bills. Seeing no further testimony, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2931, and we will open up a work session on House Bill 3328. Representative Flores, can you take the... Representative, you've been busy last month or so on some commissioned work group.
Yes, I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Linda Flores. I'm State Representative for House District 51. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, at your direction, there was a work group that was convened to review some concerns, some bills that were brought forward, and issues raised in regard to government standards, practices, commissions, and some process systems and procedures of concern to interested groups. And members of our five-week process were Genoa Ingram, representing the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, Sandy Flicker, Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative, John DiLorenzo, entity on his own, Christy Monson from the Oregon Cities Association, Candace Haynes, city attorney for the City of McMinnville, two members of the General Standards and Practices Commission, Dave Moss and Carl Wiesentainer. And we had Randy Tucker, had also from Thousand Friends of Oregon, was assigned to work with us. And we had visits from Henry Lorenzen, attorney, and Chuck Bennett, and a couple of others during the course of our work. First off, you had indicated that we had assignments to take a look at common ground for the bills that were brought before us, how we could best address the key concerns of local entities and local boards when questions were brought about advice from legal counsel, and then sometimes people would find themselves in trouble. Some of the opinions that have in the past been issued by the commission, and it was actually a very good open process, and I think during the 5 weeks after we spent our first work session just kind of shooting sparks into the air and finding out where we all might be coming down, we started to move towards some definition and areas of agreement. It was at our second meeting, I believe, that Randy Tucker from Thousand Friends of Oregon brought discussion for us that perhaps this was not the best fit for the concerns of the bill that he was bringing forward, whereas we were looking at perhaps the process. His concern was more towards the end game of determinations that were made by boards, not necessarily the people that were involved, and that was the common element for the other entities here. And then we also had for two of our meetings, we had, or perhaps three, Legislative Counsel Ted Riedlinger, who drafted amendments, and today you have before you -4 amendments, which, as I understood it at our last gathering, we had driven to concurrence on all of the areas that had been addressed. Some of the substantive issues having dealt with open meetings, conflicts of interest, group limits, personal gain, disclosure, and some of the procedural matters regarding strict liability, whether it was intentional or unintentional, and tracking those types of violations, some campaign framework discussions, and all of those. So if it would be all right with you, Mr. Chair and committee members, would ask Mr. Riedlinger to come forward and go over the -4 amendments with us.
Okay, thank you. Ted Riedlinger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ted Reutlinger from the Legislative Counsel's Office. I thought what I would do, if you like, is just go through the major changes that are contained in the -4 amendments, just in the order in which they appear in the amendments. There's some 15 specific changes that I think are significant and contained in here. And before I get started, you'll note that throughout the bill there are a host of form and style changes that I'm not going to discuss. They're changing may to shall to may, making terms consistent, things like that. This law has been around for a long time without a lot of editing. So we took the opportunity to apply our current form and style rules. On page 1 of the Dash 4 amendments, the first major change is down on line 19 and 20, and that changes the definition of the word business as it's used in the ethics law. The reason that that is ultimately important is that under current law, if you are a public official and you are associated with a 501c corporation, a nonprofit corporation, and you are not compensated as a member of that board, then it's okay for you to take official public action that might financially benefit the nonprofit. What that means is, under current law, if you are a compensated member of that 501c3 board, it's illegal for you as a public official to take action that might financially benefit or result in a financial detriment, avoidance of financial detriment to the nonprofit. What this language does is say that it doesn't matter if you're a compensated member of that nonprofit board or not. If you take official public action that benefits the board or that avoids financial detriment, then that would be legal. And that's the change from current law. The second major change is on page 3, lines 23 to 27. This is part of the group's desire to treat relatives and spouses the same as public officials in certain instances. What this change does is amend the definition of gift, specifically things that are exempted from the definition of gift, so that under this language it would be permissible for a relative, a spouse of a public official, to receive food, lodging, and travel when they accompany a public official who is acting, who's appearing in their official capacity. This is important because it ties into the $100 gift limit. In other words, the giving of this material now to a relative would not fall within that limit and would be exempt.
Question?
Person Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have the definition of a relative anywhere?
Page 5.
Oh, never mind, then we're getting there.
I was just looking for it myself.
Okay.
That question, Mr. Stanley. Yes, why would that change be made? Why did the group want to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, if you'll recall some of the earlier testimony or discussion that was had before this committee, which prompted the work group to go forward, was the instance where firemen were having to have their girlfriends rather than their wives come to their dinners because they exceeded, right. They were at a $35 value. This allows firemen to bring their spouses rather than their girlfriends to the fireman's dinner. That is a certain example.
Okay. Yeah, I do remember that testimony. Thank you.
And I'm sorry.
Is this slightly broader than that? Does this move to encompass a much bigger picture than just that type of thing?
It does. And one of the participants in the group would probably be a good one to address that, if I could have her come forward.
Okay.
Yeah, well, why don't we instead just go through this, and then that will be coming through, I think, from one of those who are going to testify later. And just to clarify that firemen don't have girlfriends and spouses. They have spouses that kind of get changed. They call them girlfriends because they're able to come to dinners where spouses are not able to come to dinners.
Yes, sir.
Like that.
Mr. Fairman, that was an inside baseball. I took that for granted. We all understood that.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jen.
The next changes are on pages 5 and 6. And this amends one of the more important statutes in the ethics code, which is the statute that says that a public official can't use official position to obtain financial benefit or avoid financial detriment if that gain or avoidance wouldn't otherwise be available but for the fact that they're a public official. It's known generically as the but-for test. What happens on page 6 is that three new exemptions are carved out beginning on line 5. The first one would provide that it's okay for a public official to receive something of value from a person who does not have a legislative or an administrative interest in the governmental body that the official works in or represents. Under the existing law, the gift ban, the $100 gift ban, prohibits a person who has a legislative or administrative interest from giving over $100 in a calendar year. So the converse of that is if somebody is a person who does not have a legislative interest or an administrative interest, the current law has been interpreted to prohibit any giving from that person. What this would do would say that if you don't have any conceivable legislative or administrative interest, it's okay for you to give something of value to a public official. The next change begins on line 12, and this is another effort to carve out an exemption, and it basically says that if an agency or unit of local government, for example, specifically approves it, that it's okay for a public official or relative to receive some sort of non-remunerative benefit, and that means something that's not paid, something besides cash. The things that we're talking about here are the dog leg trip examples, the use of government cell phone examples, those types of benefits that can accrue to a public official but aren't given to that person in the form of cash. And the last one there starts on line 17. That was contained in another separate bill, and it basically said that it's okay for a public official to make recommendations about the official's own salary in the course of budget negotiations or other budget processes. There was a commission opinion that said that that was a violation of law. That opinion, as I understand it, has since been rescinded. But the group decided that they wanted this provision in the bill anyway. The next change is on page 9. You could actually look at the changes on page 9 and 10 are both simply technical fixes to the reporting statutes. If the change in the first section goes through about allowing relatives of public officials to receive certain gift, lodging, or travel, then these two changes on page 9 and 10 simply require reporting of those benefits that are received.
Just to clarify that, yeah. Ted, seeing that it's adding the relative of the public official, is it the combined expense of the two is not to exceed 100, or is it individually $100 per person?
I think it would be $100 per person.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The next major change is on line for page 13. Line 6. This is the long statute that describes the commission's investigatory responsibilities in the preliminary review phase and things that happen after that. When somebody files a complaint with the commission or the commission begins an action on their own, all this new language here on page 13 does is say that if a complaint is filed against a candidate, a public official or a candidate who is a candidate, and that complaint comes within 61 days prior to an election, that the candidate may request that the commission put off the preliminary review phase until after the election is over. It then goes on to say that the preliminary review phase then kicks in at the first meeting of the commission after the election is held. Down on line 24 and 25, there's new language about the disclosure of public records, which I'll talk about in a minute, so we can kind of skip over that. The same change is made on page 18. We have to double amend this particular statute because there are amendments that are not going to become operative until next year. So as a technical matter, this one statute is amended twice in these amendments. The changes are identical. The next change is on page 21, starting at line 27. And this new language directs the commission to adopt rules instead of using advisory opinions when the commission wants to set a standard or adopt some statement or make an interpretation that's going to have general applicability. The existing law that appears on page 21 allows the commission to issue various opinions upon request or on its own motion. And apparently the commission has used that process to issue general interpretations of the law, which is fine. But what this language does is direct the commission to instead use the rulemaking process to issue those general statements of applicability. On page 22 are amendments to the commission's civil penalty provisions. There are a couple of things happening there. The first one starts on page 22, line 17, where it carves out sort of a safe harbor where the commission may not impose a civil penalty if the person against whom the commission is proceeding can show that the violation occurred as a result of the governing body of a public body acting upon the advice of counsel to that governing body. You can see in this amendment that very similar language exists in the existing law with regard to violations of the executive session portion of the public meetings law. What this does is extend that to also cover violations that occur under Chapter 244 under the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Law. And then the second change starts on line 20, where it gives the commission the authority, instead of imposing a civil penalty, to just issue a letter of reprimand to somebody if they find that the law was violated, but some mitigating circumstances exist. They could issue a letter of reprimand instead of actually fining the person with a civil penalty. Then on page 23, lines 8 and 9 are amendments to the lobbying statutes. What this language does is require any lobbyist who is compensated to register with the commission no matter what. Under the existing law, you could be a compensated lobbyist but still not be required to register if you haven't met the 24-hour and $100 lobbying expenditure threshold. So this just changes it to say that if you're getting paid to lobby, you have to register with the commission. And then down on lines 23...
I have a question on that.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Explain that again. I'm not sure that... Do lobbyists always have to register with CSPC?
Mr. Chair, Representative Myers-Anderson, under the existing law, there is a threshold where you could be a lobbyist but not have to register. It says that the registration law doesn't apply to a person who spends not more than 24 hours during a calendar quarter lobbying and who does not spend an amount in excess of $100 lobbying during a calendar quarter. So if you stay underneath those thresholds and you're getting paid, you still do not have to register. As soon as you exceed one of those thresholds, then you do. What this does is say, no matter what, if you're getting paid, you have to register.
And what is involved with registration?
That's the next statute, Section 10. Basically, you have to fill out the form with the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and then you also get into the expenditure reporting system. And what's happening in Section 10 is just an amendment to accommodate people who are compensated but haven't exceeded the 24 hours or the $100. Under this amendment, they would have to register within 5 business days after they agree to provide services for compensation to lobby. Okay, we're almost done.
And just one for the follow-up. They don't have to pay a fee, I mean, when they register.
Mr. Chair, Representative Modest Anderson, I think not. The legislature did pass a lobbying fee, but the court ruled that to be unconstitutional within the last 5 years or so. On page 25 is an amendment to the public meetings law. What's happening there is we're adding a new requirement that all executive sessions be recorded electronically. Executive sessions are those sessions where the governing body of a public body may meet in private without the public being invited. The statute sets out a host of reasons why a public body can meet in executive session. If it can be shown that a public body met in executive session to discuss something that should have been conducted in a public meeting, then obviously you have a violation of the law. This would require all those executive sessions to be taped, which would be helpful in enforcing the statute that relates to executive sessions.
Ted, can you comment on executive sessions being exempt from disclosure of public records?
Yes.
And how this relates?
In looking at the statutes, you can see in Section 11 and in Section 12, there are provisions in both of those statutes about disclosure. Section 11 seems to say that when a public body holds an executive session, that the records of that executive session are not subject to disclosure as long as they are for the reason, as long as they relate to the reason that the executive session was held. In other words, if the minutes talk about things that they show that they talked about things that they shouldn't have talked about, then that could be subject to disclosure. Then when you get over to Section 12, there's also language there on lines 20 through 24, which seem to say that when the commission gets information delivered to it with respect to executive sessions, that that information is also exempt from disclosure to the extent that it relates to the subject matter of the executive session. So these two statutes seem to exempt the executive session material from disclosure, as does the public the public records law acknowledges these provisions in its text as well.
So the essence then is that basically if there is a complaint filed about what happens in an executive session, this recording would just go to the commission, but it would not be allowed to be disclosed.
Mr. Chair, that's the way I understand this bill to work.
Okay, Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ted, I understand that caucus meetings are considered executive sessions. Is that true, and would caucus meetings then be electronically recorded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, no, I don't think this would require caucus meetings to be electronically recorded. The legislature is subject to different rules as far as public meetings go because that's constitutional. It's based in the Constitution and the legislative authority there. So I do not think that this would require the electronic recording of caucus meetings under the executive session provision.
Okay. Let's proceed.
Finally, on page 26, lines 24 to 27, all this language does is say that when the commission does get an electronic recording of an executive session and the commission is finished with its action, it has to deliver that recording back to the public body from whence it came. The amendments on pages 27 and 28 are technical. Actually, the top of page 29, there are some statutes relating to higher education that because of the changes we made in the ethics law required us to put in this phrase non-remunerative benefit in a couple of places. Those are basically just conforming amendments. The last thing in section 15, the bill does have an emergency clause. It's effective on passage. However, the new lobbyist registration provisions would not become operative until January 1st of 2004, and anybody who would be required to register under those new rules would have until February 1st to register. The rest of this transition language simply clarifies who the law applies to when it goes into effect. And that's basically it.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions, Mr. Reitlinger? Okay. Thank you. And thank you, Representative. You can come on back, and we can call forward. Let's ask John DiLorenzo and Genoa Ingram. I kind of figured you two were the ones that started all this. with actually good, I think, good intentions, and just looking for a reaction on what the work group ended up producing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I am not representing any client with respect to this bill, nor do I presently have any cases pending before the Government Standards and Practices Commission, so it was sort of a fortuitous time for me to involve myself in the process without any current cases. Genoa and I had the privilege to serve on the work group with members of the Commission and others, and are pleased to report that we came to agreement and an accommodation. I feel that one of the obligations of a person who serves on such a group is to make it very clear to you as the ultimate tribunal here as to whether we fully and completely endorse the product. And I would like to say that I do fully and completely endorse the product. Many of the provisions are compromises, but that's what politics is all about. I think that to the extent that were compromises, they were all made in good faith. They were all made after significant discussion and a wonderful vetting of the issues. The items that were of most importance to me, which I had an opportunity to testify on in advance before this process began, were as follows. First, requiring rulemaking whenever the Commission attempted to proclaim a rule of general applicability. The bill does a marvelous job in making clear that although advisory opinions still exist for the purpose of providing a safe harbor to a public official who requests it, to the extent that the Commission is going to make a rule of general applicability, the Commission must engage in formal rulemaking, invite the public to participate, hold hearings, and the like. In addition, what I had referred to in my earlier testimony is the minutia, the cell phone policies, auto policies, frequent flyer policies, and similar issues are now very well addressed in the bill. The bill recognizes, the amendments recognize that these are matters of personnel policy. There may be some local governments who feel that it is much better to pay one fee and to allow employees to make personal calls, reimbursed or not, for those who have to travel great distances and must be on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Other local governments may feel that that is not appropriate. What the bill permits is for government entities to either by rule or by ordinance create their personnel policy, and as long as a local official comports themselves in accordance with the policy, they're fine. It also expands the Commission's flexibility to allow for warning letters in lieu of penalties. I think the Commission sort of had an unwritten rule of dismissing cases when maybe warning letters were more appropriate, but this gives them yet another flexible tool. Of importance to the chair was the ability to rely upon advice of counsel, and the bill basically prohibits imposition of civil penalties when a public official is acting on advice of the body's legal counsel. It permits the subject of a complaint to request a delay of the deliberations when the complaint is filed within 61 days of an election. The purpose of that, if the subject is running in the election, and the purpose of that provision was to prevent the commission from being used as a political pawn in an election. There's nothing that prohibits opponents from complaining about one another in the press, but the commission should not be used as a political tool, and that was the purpose of that. And finally, of great importance to me, and this is of special importance to Ms. Ingram, it was the ability to treat relatives on the same plane as legislators. And to respond to Representative Verger's question, the scenario that I raised was as follows. There is a need to take a committee on a field trip to inspect a facility. Let's say the facility is in Hermiston, Oregon, and the trip will require an overnight stay, probably. To the extent that private resources finance that trip, they can go ahead and do it with respect to a legislator, as long as this bears on the legislator's official capacity. But what happens if the legislator happens to be a single mother who has a child and otherwise would not go but for the ability to bring the child along? And what if some daycare facilities are required during the actual visitation of the facility? Under current law, that could not be provided. Our view is that there have been so many problems in this area that relatives should be treated on the same plane as legislators for the purpose of these types of trips, provided the trips have a bearing on the legislator's official function and capacity. Anyway, there are other provisions. Ms. Ingram will talk about those, but I just want to not leave without making clear my thanks to Representative Flores for the wonderful job she did as the chair of this work group. Many of us have been vigorous adversaries over the years within the work group, and Mr. Chairman, she was a very fine facilitator. She created an atmosphere that encouraged collaboration, encouraged full discussion, and ultimately conciliation, which led to this agreement. So thank you very much, and thank you also to Dave Mowry and Ted for all the staffing. It was a wonderful experience, and it's a great compromise. I fully endorse it.
Yep, thank you. Singer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are a lot of issues to talk about in this bill. You've already heard them all discussed, so I'm not going to go over the points. A couple of things that John said that I would like to echo is that this work group experience really was of whether or not, you know, regardless of what happens with this bill, it was a valuable experience for everyone to see everyone else's perspective, and for us to have an appreciation of the tools needed by the commission to get their job done as well. And I have to echo, too, that Representative Flores really did set the stage for a spirit of cooperation among all of the parties. As John said, a lot of us, you know, who have been adversaries for a very long time, and sometimes not, but it just really helped to have that atmosphere set from the beginning. And once again, my members would like me to convey to you that our purpose in bringing the bills forward that we did was not in any way, shape, or form a criticism of the commission or the commission staff. We just felt that the law itself was very convoluted, difficult to understand. It needed to be streamlined, and we believe that that is what the Dash 4 amendments do. I have outlined the key points of the bill in my written testimony, which you have before you. The rulemaking portion of it, I think, is very, very valuable. It's important that the public have input when there are these policies being made that impact the entire state. The second thing was with regard to the families or the spouses. And in my case, we were primarily interested in the spouse of a volunteer firefighter, and that it had become kind of a joke in the fire service about the having to swap wives in order to go to the annual banquet. And
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I mean, it really, and I think the commission will tell you that it was said more than once during the work group meetings that the fire service is one of the biggest offenders, and it's for the very reason that people want to give things sometimes to the firefighters. And we got into the whole discussion that we heard before this committee. Is it all right to bring a plate of cookies to the fire station? And, you know, people weren't sure, and the laws just aren't clear. And we believe that the Dash 4 amendments go a long, long way. I'm going to address one last point because I think it may come up at some point. The taping of the executive sessions, the special districts and the Oregon Fire District Directors Association in particular were the only ones that were opposed to that piece of the bill. But I want to tell you that that got a full airing, that we were definitely in the minority, and that we worked out a compromise that we believe addresses our concern. And we just want to make it clear that we are wholeheartedly on board in support of this bill. Again, thank you for letting me participate. It was a wonderful experience, and I'm happy to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
I'm not sure that I'm asking the right person, but I'm curious as to what the history is of the limit, the $100 limit. Maybe I was the right person. You know, how long we've had it and that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, I'm not an attorney, and probably Mr. DiLorenzo could answer the technical portion of it, but may I address something that I'd like to say about the $100 limit? We firmly believed if there was going to be a cap or restrictions on that $100 limit, it didn't seem right to us that where there's an administrative interest, for example, I know that you all will be voting on this bill, so there is a cap on how much I can spend if I were to take you all to dinner. With regard to a volunteer firefighter or someone of that nature, another public official, where there is no legislative or administrative interest, we couldn't understand why why the law would be more restrictive in that case than where there is an administrative or legislative interest. And in fact, it got to the point of ridiculousness. Somebody asked me, they said, well, do you think the firefighter's going to want to get to somebody's house quicker if they gave them cookies? And, you know, it was that sort of thing. I can't tell you how long this law, the $100 cap, has been in effect, probably as old as the ethics laws itself from the beginning. But it just seemed if you were going to be stricter, you should be stricter in those cases where there is an administrative interest, not where there is not an administrative interest.
Representative Close?
I just would like to ask Mr. DiLorenzo if he concurs with the Legislative Council opinion about caucus meetings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I haven't, in this brief period of time, had an opportunity to research it, but it is my inclination that because the legislature is controlled by constitutional authority, that first of all, a statute wouldn't necessarily control whether the legislature can meet and could have an opportunity to provide for its own rules. But secondly, it seems to me that you don't go into executive session when you have caucus meetings. Those are just a matter of House rule and Senate rule. So it is my general view that this bill does not impact the ability of the caucuses to provide for their own rules, although you may wish to just address that to the Legislative Council formally, even if you want. But I don't believe the bill impacts that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Flores.
And to wrap up, ask Christy Monson to come forward and Dave Moss.
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, Christy Munson representing the League of Oregon Cities. I just came to say we too appreciate the process and Representative Flores' leadership in the issue. We are fully on board with the bill, and just very quickly to point out the three major things that we believe cities benefit from this bill. I brought Candace Haynes, city attorney from the city of McMinnville.
Chair Doyle and members of the committee, excuse me, I have a terrible cold, so I'm in a fog here, and I apologize. I hope you can hear me. again, our appreciation for everything that was done, and my personal appreciation for being allowed to serve on this committee. It was really a terrific experience, and we really appreciated everything that particularly Representative Flores did for us. There were three main points that this bill addressed that we were very concerned about insofar as cities. When I came and talked to you before, I talked to you about the fact that the ethics code had become a trap for the wary rather than for the unwary. And I was very worried about that because I've been practicing law, local government law, for almost 25 years. And there were times when I'd look at things and there was no way I could figure out how to make the various components of the code work together. And that had become a real issue with me and a real issue with a lot of other city attorneys. And the chance to address those issues in this work group was really, really beneficial, I think, to everyone. The particular issues that we brought forward that we are very glad to see and fixed, as we believe, by the current language, are the following. The non-remunerative benefits, such as being able to use internet access, cell phones, etc. This is going to be a major issue because cities and counties are going to be able to now adopt rules that say how their own employees are going to be able to use these things that are outside of salary. I know I have a number of employees who are now carrying two cell phones, a personal one and a city-owned cell phone. And when they need to call home, other than the brief call that's allowed, if you're going to be a little bit late or something, they whip out their personal cell phone, they hope. I do have a couple of employees who've gotten them confused, and we've had to work that out too. But being able to adopt an ordinance or a resolution within the city that will say it's okay if you use your city-owned cell phone, provided you reimburse the city, is going to be a huge benefit to many of our employees. The second thing that we particularly were glad to see fixed by the changes in the wording was the issue of whether or not the issue of a city manager, a county administrative officer, someone at that level being able to actually go forward to the budget committee and say, this is where my salary range seems to come in when you look at the comparable cities, counties, etc. As it was, because that person would have been acting in a position which was supporting his own or her own salary, it was probably, although there wasn't a firm opinion on this, it was probably going to be a problem for that county administrative officer or city manager to make a salary recommendation for his or herself, and that was a very, very awkward situation. There didn't seem to be a good way around it. So we're very gratified that we seem to have fixed that problem. And the third problem that was very concerning to us, particularly after September 11th, was the outpouring of goodwill that came from people who wanted to do something, mostly for our public safety people, our police and fire people, but they didn't have a legislative interest in the city, and there was no way that these people could do anything because the way that the law was written, they didn't have a legislative interest, so they couldn't bring the plate of cookies, the bouquet of flowers. They couldn't offer the donut, the cup of coffee, whatever. So we're very glad to have some clarity on that so that we can move forward and hopefully have a lot more clarity and a lot more assurance that we are doing the right thing when we give advice and when we act as local government officials. Yep. So thank you.
Thomas Moss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Dave Moss. I'm the chairman of the, I'll say, Ethics Commission. I can never remember the initials. By and large, I have to say my goals were met here, and the foremost goal that I had going into the work group was to provide flexibility and accountability at the local level, and it's been touched on here that if there is going to be an allowance for some of these non-remunerative issues, then it's going to be done through an official action of the local body, and the local body will be answerable to its constituents. That's fair, that's open, and that's a good way to enforce this. The second goal I really had going in was to improve common sense compliance and reduce the nickel and dime complaints that we get. Nobody likes the gotcha situations. The person who's caught in them, we don't like them, and this will reduce them dramatically. And the third thing was to improve the commission work process itself. And I can parse through this bill and find a couple things that actually do that. And so as with any bill, it has compromises in it. If I started with a blank sheet of paper, I wouldn't end up with this bill. But I think on balance, it does a good job of looking after the public interest in the code of ethics and at the practical interest of how you implement it. The only issue I'd like to bring up, and it has to do with the rulemaking. This will be a change for the commission, and we will, in fact, proceed along those grounds. The language talks about needing a rule to implement the statute a little bit, and in the work group we talked about this, and a legislative council assured me that we don't have to adopt a rule just to read the statute and apply the statute. What we have to do is adopt a rule to expand, clarify, whatever. And I just want to make sure that that was in the record, that we aren't shut down until we have 50 pages of rules.
Good point. Although some wouldn't mind that.
Well, you know,
separate story.
At the Ways and Means Committee, that decision may be made anyway. So.
Good point. Representative Barnhart?
Oh, thank you. Has it been the experience of the practice of the commission in the past to sometimes issue statements to say we're going to interpret this rule this way or do this behavior that way? Is that what's happened?
Chairman Doyle, Representative Barnhart, in the past, when a problem arises several times, the commission has then sat down and worked out what we believe the law says and how we're going to interpret it and reissue it in a broad-based advisory opinion. There were two kinds of advisory opinions. One was an official would come to us and here's the situation XYZ. What can I or can I not do? And we would issue an advisory opinion specific to those circumstances. The second type was one that frankly, it's easier and more convenient, and we thought we were doing a public service, still do think we were doing a public service, to give a broad explanation of what the boundaries would be on things like cell phone or frequent flyer miles. That will now be done through a rulemaking process rather than a simpler advisory opinion process, but that's okay. That's okay. Mm-hmm. It'll bring the public more in, and we'll deal with that.
And a follow-up. The first one, the specific question one, you'll still follow the procedure you've been following?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And to those in the work group, certainly my thanks, and thanks to Representative Flores for leading that up as well. I believe it's very good work for the task that you were provided, and it shows, I think, throughout this that those were very productive meetings, and I thought come up with some good solutions. I do ask you one more thing, though, as a work group, and that's that as this gets passed out, and I'm assuming it'll be passed from the House chamber, that it's also going to be given your attention as well on the Senate side so that we can move this through as quickly as we can. So we are in work session. Representative Flores, want to move adoption of the Dash 4s?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3328.
Okay, Representative Flores has moved adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3328. Any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, it may be that I'm confusing the two bills, but wasn't there a comment that this might need some minor tweak, or was it about the other bill that we were talking about today? I don't.
Not on this one.
Not on this. Okay.
The other bill today will be tweaked.
Yeah. So. Okay. Yeah.
Representative Berger.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this addresses some things to clarify. I do think that in some particular instances, it softens it just a bit. And I guess that my word of caution is that perception is everything in public life. It doesn't really matter what the rules are. If a person perceives that you're using the system to your advantage, that's very harmful, not only to the person, but it's harmful to the entire body. And so I think rules are good, but I think we have to be careful in the way we use them. And I have no objections with the bill. I just always have the concern that people always be a little bit like Caesar's wife, and that's beyond reproach.
Thank you. See no further discussion. Call the roll.
Irving Ackman.
Aye.
Irving Barnhart.
Aye.
Excused.
Suzanne Flores.
Aye.
Suzanne Lewis Anderson.
Aye.
Suzanne Virgin.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, and the dash four amendments are adopted to House Bill 3328. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3328 pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3328 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair and Representative Verger, I would just let you know that there was considerable discussion about the very point that you raised, and that I think every entity represented was concerned about public perception and wanting how to make sure there were safeguards in place and the judicious use of these things, and to meet specifically the intimate needs, I think, that were addressed in regard to some of our public heroes, I think really was the overriding concern. And I would also, Mr. Chair, just like to say thank you for the opportunity, and it was just for me a great experience with a great group of people, and I appreciate your participation and the many, many, many continuing to give opportunities that the representatives from the Standards and Practices Commission gave us. So, thank you. I really appreciate you all.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, call the roll.
Jackson.
Aye.
Aye.
Hold time.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, and House Bill 3328 will move to the floor. The due pass as amended recommendation, and we'll have Representative Flores carry this bill. And that ends our work session on House Bill 3328, and seeing nothing further before the committee, we are adjourned.
Well.